This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Broadcaster Bob Costas has been on sports' biggest stages, the Super Bowl.
From the happy San Francisco 49er locker room, the team of the 80s, the Super Bowl champions, I'm Bob Costas.
The NBA Finals.
Jordan against Anderson. He's still Michael Jordan.
The World Series.
A pop in the shallow left. The New York Yankees, world champions, team of the decade, most successful franchise of the century.
And the Olympics.
There's a word you hear in Brazil, one of those words that captures an entire idea. In this case, that word is gambiarra. And the idea is that somehow, in the end, things will come together. Here in Rio, that's pretty much what happened. An Olympics that faced...
Before Bob Costas was on those national and international stages, he was a broadcaster in St. Louis. And even after his career went afield, Costas continued to make his home in St. Louis for more than 30 years. Costas is now back in town to receive a major award. For more, here's producer Alex Hoyer.
This Saturday evening at Stiefel Theater, Bob Costas will receive the Musial Awards Stan Musial Lifetime Achievement Award for Sportsmanship. It's the highest award for sportsmanship that recognizes, quote, iconic sports figures who exemplify sportsmanship and embody the class, dignity, generosity, excellence, civility, and integrity synonymous with Stan the Man. Bob Costas, welcome to St. Louis on the Air, and congratulations.
Thank you, Alex. It means a lot because, A, it's St. Louis, and 1A, it's Stan Musial.
Yeah, and we'll get to more of your experience with Stan a little bit later in our conversation. You are no stranger to St. Louis radio. It was in St. Louis on KMOX where you got your professional start in 1974.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you were hired to call games for the American Basketball Association's Spirits of St. Louis.
And we're going to get Steve Jones coming in, see if he can generate a little offense. He's the kind of man who comes off the bench and puts the ball in the bucket for you, Bill, and he replaces Milt Williams.
You were just 22 years old when you came to St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
What was involved in your coming here?
Well, I had just finished up at Syracuse University. I actually did some minor league hockey in the old Eastern Hockey League, the league that the Paul Newman movie Slapshot is based on, $30 a game. And I thought I'd be in Syracuse for a while. I thought I was very lucky at 21 to be on the air doing sports and occasionally some non-sports things and then calling the hockey games on the radio. It was a dual radio and television operation. But a friend of mine, who I actually had as my roommate at Syracuse, he was a relative of the guy who was the president of the Spirits of St. Louis. Who had just moved to St. Louis from Carolina. They were the Carolina Cougars of the old ABA. And so my friend Roger says, you should send a tape to KMOX. They'll be carrying the games. And my thought was, A, they're not going to hire a 22-year-old kid. And B, I don't really have that much basketball. I found something that I did on the campus station when I was 19 or 20. And I listened to it, and it was better than I thought. But I had someone edit out the choppy parts and then string together the calls that seemed smooth. And if there were any references to the score that was out of sequence, we edited that out. So it seemed like one continuous 10 minutes or so. And then I had him re-record it with the bass slightly up and the treble slightly down so I would sound older and a bit more authoritative. And we sent it off to KMOX, and somehow they liked it. And I guess they whittled it down to a handful of possibilities, and they brought me into St. Louis for an interview. And I spoke with Jack Buck and with Bob Hyland, who ran the station at that time, and I was well aware, as a young student of the history of sports broadcasting, I was well aware that KMOX was not just a prestigious radio station, but it was a sports broadcasting mecca, that Joe Garagiola had been there and Harry Carey had been there, and of course Jack Buck had been there, and Dan Kelly, who was the premier hockey announcer of his day, and on. And I thought, well, I'll just meet these people and it'll be a good connection somewhere along the line. And lo and behold, They hired me. Perhaps the fact that I was willing to work for their initial offer of $11,000 a year, to which my thought was, if I had $11,000 and I had to pay you the 11 grand for the job, I would. So naturally, I accepted.
Now, the spirits of St. Louis didn't last. The team didn't survive the merger with the NBA.
Right.
But you lasted.
Yes.
And stayed at KMOX for several more years. What did you do at KMOX outside of basketball?
Well, they liked me, and so Mr. Hyland wanted to keep me around. I immediately shifted to Missouri basketball. They have very good teams in the 70s and early 80s, coached by Norm Stewart. So I did Missouri basketball, and then I also hosted sports talk programs and was involved in some non-sports stuff. Jack Carney was a legendary morning man on KMOX, did an entertainment and kind of politics, anything, just a combination of whatever interested him. And sometimes he would have me on his show. And it was all kind of a laboratory for learning how to be a broadcaster. I think it's much easier. It's not easy at all, but it's a little less difficult to go from radio to television than it would be to go from television to radio. Because on radio, you have to paint the entire picture. It's a blank canvas. On television, if we're talking about a sports broadcast, you're complementing the picture or putting a caption beneath the picture. The whole theater of the mind that is radio at its best, KMOX exemplified that, and I was immersed in that, and I learned a lot by osmosis from all the people who surrounded me. I never consciously copied any of them, but I was influenced by them, influenced for the better.
Now, you mentioned Jack Carney. I mentioned on social media on Blue Sky that I'd be talking with you today and asked if people had questions. I heard from Katie, who said, I remember listening to KMOX when I was getting ready for school. My mom didn't like rock in the mornings. I would hear the hype from Jack Carney about young Bobby Costas.
That's right, yeah.
Going to be talking later that day. I'd love to hear about the early days and who all gave him his start.
Well, I think we've just answered how I got my start there. But Jack Carney was instrumental because he introduced me to a broader audience beyond the people who would have listened to a struggling pro basketball team that only lasted for 2 years. Jack Carney was a real sensation in St. Louis. It's hard to describe for those who weren't around. The quality of his show and the uniqueness of his delivery and the way he brought so many different elements to it. He was really a master of the form. And he was so popular that anything he thought was interesting, the audience figured it was interesting too. And so when he gave me his blessing, in effect, I think that made me a St. Louisan more so than calling the basketball games.
You joined NBC Sports in 1980.
Yeah.
What was it like to make that jump to the national stage?
Well, at first, my main concern was that not only was I young, I looked even younger than I was. I was 28 and probably looked like I was 15 or 16. In fact, the guy who ran NBC Sports at that time, legendary figure in the history of television, Don Olmeyer, called me into his office after a couple of months and he said, we really like your work. We think you have a future here. Let me ask you something. How old are you? I said, I'm 28. He said, damn it, you look like you're 14. And then he had a brainstorm. He said, how much older do you think you would look if you grew a beard? This was his actual thought, if you grew a beard. And I said, oh, 5 years at least. And he perked up. He said, 5 years, really? I said, yeah, because that's how long it would take to grow it. And so the whole idea went down the drain. I don't know if it was a serious idea or not. So my big concern was that people would not take me seriously, that I was unknown, and that I looked so young. And I think right at the beginning, the first year or so, I was technically competent, but I think I was a little stilted. I didn't let my own personality come out because I was trying to prove to people that I was mature enough and authoritative enough to the extent that a sports broadcaster has to be authoritative. And then two things happened that really helped me. I was playing golf with Olmeyer and some other people in Hawaii. We were covering the Hula Bowl. We're playing golf, and I'm telling them stories and cracking jokes. And Olmeyer says to me, that's the Bob Costas I want to see and hear. If you never change the way you're doing it now, you'll have a good career. But if you bring to bear your sense of humor and your personality, you'll have a better than good career. And shortly after that, David Letterman began his late night show on NBC. So it was the spring of 1982. He'd only been on the air for a month or so. And one of his many crazy ideas that kind of formed his legend, because he broke the whole late night form. So he had an idea that he wanted to do elevator races. And the premise of the elevator races was that they would select some people at random from the audience. They'd give them faux Olympic torches, and that they'd race down the hallway at 30 Rock. They'd get on the elevator. They'd go down to the lobby. They'd run around the building. They'd come back up the elevator, and whoever reappeared in the sixth-floor studio first would be awarded the gold medal for elevator racing. And so they needed a commentator. And they asked for Marv Albert, and they asked for Don Crickey, and better-known Kurt Gowdy, whoever was around, better-known names, and none of them were around. And I was sitting in the sports office, and they said, well, Bob Costas is here. Send them up. And Letterman, who's a big sports fan, and later became very, very helpful to me in my career, he was terrific to me. But to show you how relatively unknown I was, he introduced me as Bob Costa, which is a natural mistake. And I was down in the lobby, but I completely understood from watching Letterman. I understood exactly what he wanted. He wanted this mock reverent sort of thing, like it was coming from Mount Olympus, but with some asides mixed in. So I did that. He loved it. And then he brought me back several times for other antics and sometimes just to be a guest. And when I heard the audience laughing, and I got that response, and in effect an okay sign from a guy like David Letterman, that pushed me further toward being a little more irreverent, a little more of myself, as opposed to just kind of connect the dots sports broadcasting. Mm-hmm. He did the same thing for me on a national basis as Jack Carney did for me on a local basis in St. Louis.
Mm. So irreverence, humor, and being yourself is what really elevated your career. One of my earliest baseball memories, mm-hmm. I was 10 years old, and it came in game one of the 1996 American League Championship Series between the New York Yankees and the Baltimore Orioles, and you had the call on this Derek Jeter hit.
In right field, Tarasco going back to the track, to the wall. And what happens here? He contends that a fan reaches up and touches it. But Richie Garcia says no, it's a home run. Here comes Davey Johnson out to argue as Jeter comes across to tie the game.
That's Bob Costas with the call during game one of the 1996 ALCS. The fan did indeed reach over the wall, but it was ruled a home run.
Oh, by a lot. Because there was no replay at that time. There was replay on television, and we immediately said that Tarasco, the right fielder, was correct. It wasn't even a close call.
Right.
It would be an easy reversal now under the replay rules, but there were no replay rules then. The home run stood. The Yankees tied the game, and then they won it in extra innings.
Yeah. It's a great call. And I'm thinking of broadcasters that are great and ones that are okay. I mean, they are serviceable. They get the mm-hmm. job done. What are the things that go from elevating a broadcaster from okay, gets the job done, to great?
I think there are varying definitions of it. There are lots of people, if we just confine it for a moment to baseball broadcasters, who you could rightly call great, but they're not all the same. Jack Buck wasn't the same as Vin Scully. Jack Buck wasn't the same as Harry Carey either when they were side by side in the booth in St. Louis, when Carey was his true self. He became kind of a cartoon character on WGN calling the Cubs games, but beloved because of his personality and how much people sensed that he loved both baseball and the Budweiser he was selling you while he was calling baseball. So there's so many different ways. Ernie Harwell was kind of down, homespun sort of broadcaster in Detroit. So lots of ways to be different or to be excellent, rather. What I think they all have in common is this. They all mastered the nuts and bolts. So they're not going to botch a ground ball to shortstop. They're going to keep you up to date, especially on the radio. What inning is it? How many outs are there? What's the defensive alignment? What does the guy's stance look like? What's the pitcher's windup look like? All those kind of basic nuts and bolts things. But once you've got that down, then your own personality, your own sense of what's interesting, your own sense of humor, a little bit of sentimentality, because baseball fans feel fondness toward the game in a different way than football fans generally relate to football, as one example. See, you got to get the basics down, and then who you are comes into play.
You mentioned both Vin Scully and Jack Buck, both great broadcasters,
yes.
And they both called Vin Scully on TV, Jack Buck on the radio, the 1988 World Series, and you were involved in the TV broadcast of that game. That's the one where Kirk Gibson for the Dodgers in Game 1, he's injured, and he hits that game-winning home run. It's Jack Buck's call that I think of when I think of that game where he says, "I don't believe what I just saw.
It's two of the greatest calls in baseball history on the same play.
Yeah. What was it like to be associated with that game? What was your experience there?
Well, I was the pregame and postgame host, and I thought that I was going to be interviewing someone from the Dodgers, and I thought that they were going to lose the game. Even though it was only a one-run game, Dennis Eckersley came out of the bullpen for Oakland. He was then the best reliever in baseball, ultimately a Hall of Famer, almost untouchable. And Gibson didn't even suit up. He wasn't even introduced, wasn't on the field for the national anthem. And that's how we began the broadcast. I came on the air and said, first item of business, Kirk Gibson will not play tonight. He's not available for so much as pinch-hitting duty. And then late in the game, I snuck into the corner of the Dodger dugout, where then, at that time, you weren't supposed to be there. Now, as you watch any game, there are reporters in the dugout. They interview the manager during the game. But then that was supposedly off limits. But I wanted to have that vantage point so I could jump out on the field as soon as the game was over and do whatever interview I was going to wind up doing. And Tommy Lasorda saw me in the corner, and Tommy liked me, but Tommy was like to blow off steam. So he says to his player sitting in the dugout, "See that? Even FN NBC thinks we've lost the game. FN Costas is here already." So while I'm at that perch, I can hear down the hallway, there's a batting cage between the clubhouse and the dugout, and I could hear the sounds of a ball being hit. And I walk down to investigate, and it's Kirk Gibson, who had heard Vin Scully say, like for the fifth time during the game, "Kirk Gibson is not available tonight." So he, at some point, adrenaline took over. He was in his skivvies in the locker room. He pulls on his uniform, comes down and takes some practice swings. And my contribution was I then let the producer know, tell Vin and Joe, Joe Garagiola was with Vin Scully, tell Vin and Joe that Gibson has his uniform on. But they tried to hide him as a decoy so that Tony La Russa, who was managing the A's, would not think he was a factor. And they only brought him into the on-deck circle when Mike Davis got a walk. With two outs and nobody on, Davis walks. Gibson appears. If this was a movie, you couldn't make it any more dramatic because it didn't all happen at once. It played out over the entire game with Vin Scully noting that Gibson's absence handicaps the Dodgers, et cetera, et cetera. And then he literally comes limping out. If he had hit a ground ball, there's no way he could have ever beaten it out. He was hobbling down the first baseline. And the way it played out, my other contribution at the end was, I said to one of the producers, that reminded me of Robert Redford's last at-bat in The Natural as Roy Hobbs. And then the producer brilliantly ran with that and spent all night at NBC in Burbank intercutting Redford's at-bat as Roy Hobbs with Gibson's at-bat. And it was eerie, the similarities. I mean, Gibson wasn't bleeding from a bullet wound like Redford was, but the way they hobbled around, the looks on their faces, they both hit left-handed. Tommy Lasorda, kind of a hefty guy. Wilford Brimley played the manager of the New York Knights, and he jumped up in exultation, as did Tommy, and they each got about an inch off the ground. They mirrored each other so much that when we came on the air the next day, that's the way it began. And all I said was, echoes of a miracle. And the rest was just Randy Newman's score from The Natural played beneath this intercut of Gibson and Redford. And to show you how a great broadcast, be it Jack Buck on the radio that night or Vin Scully, who added his little grace note at the end, in a year that has been so improbable, the impossible has happened. If you had a month to think of a caption, a minute after the home run was hit and Scully on television let the crowd and the cuts of all the different reactions Dodger reactions, A's reactions. If you had a month to think of a better caption, you couldn't come up with that. And Kirk Gibson has told me and others that the way he remembers that moment, the signature moment, not just of his career as a baseball player, probably of his life, the way he remembers that moment is half the way it felt facing Eckersley in the moment that he did it, and the other half is the way NBC televised it and Vin Scully called it and the way Jack Buck called it on the radio.
And it does occur to me that in memories, and you said for a player, that's the way that he, half of the way that he remembers it. But for fans, these awesome sports moments are forever tied to the call. I think of Al Michaels and the 1980 Olympics Miracle on Ice. Does that moment live on in the same way if Al Michaels doesn't call it that way? I suspect not.
Or, no, you're right. You're 100% right.
Or my favorite sports memory is the 2011 World Series Game 6. David Freese hits the game-winning home run, and Joe Buck echoes his father from the 90s saying, "We will see you tomorrow night." I mean, I get goosebumps every time I hear that call. And I remember those sports moments, those great sports moments, because of what the broadcaster did.
It's not just a great call by Joe. It's poignant. And only he had the right to do it, to bookend with his dad. And it happened to be game six, 20 years later, sixth game, home team winning, walk off in extra innings or the ninth. I forget what Kirby Puckett's homer was. Might have been the 10th, could have been the ninth. But either way, it's a walk off. It ended the game. And then the home team won the seventh game, so the sixth game propelled them toward it. It was perfect symmetry all the way around, and Joe's call tied a ribbon around it.
Baseball, of course, wasn't your only sport. We've talked about baseball. But was it baseball that came most naturally for you?
It's definitely my first love. It's, as someone once said, in some respects, the easiest sport to do adequately, but the hardest sport to do well, because there are so many pauses and lulls in baseball, fewer now because of the pitch clock, but still it has a different rhythm to it than almost any other sport. And it calls for some references to history and some anecdotes and a relationship with the other person in the booth and touches of humor. I think the relationship between a local baseball broadcaster, especially 162 games out of the year, and that person's audience is different than a national broadcaster. Local broadcasters of baseball are beloved. They're not just admired or respected, they're beloved because that's the voice of their team. That's what their team sounds like. So baseball is definitely my first love. I think in a sense you could say hockey is almost impossible to call because of the lines changes and all the rest and the fast-paced action. Dan Kelly was great at it. Doc Emrick, more recently on NBC, was great at it. But I guess I was pretty versatile during the course of my career, not just the different sports I did, but the different roles I played, sometimes play-by-play man, sometimes host, sometimes commentator or essayist, sometimes interviewer. So there were, I guess I checked a lot of different boxes.
That sportscaster Bob Costas talking with producer Alex Hoyer. We'll have more of their conversation after this short break. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Let's return to producer Alex Hoyer's conversation with broadcaster Bob Costas.
You are back here in St. Louis to receive the Musial Awards, Stan Musial Lifetime Achievement Award for Sportsmanship. That's this Saturday evening at Stiefel Theater. You knew Stan Musial.
I did.
Who is so beloved here in St. Louis.
Yes.
You've received a lot of awards over the course of your career, but what does it mean to receive this award?
Well, as I've put it very honestly, the two awards that are most important to me, not diminishing any of the others, I appreciate them all, but being inducted into the Broadcaster's Wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame in 2018 in Cooperstown, and now this, because it's St. Louis, because it's Stan, because it has a baseball connection, all those things resonate with me. So those two are the most important to me.
Before he died in 2013, Stan Musial had asked you to speak at his funeral, and mm-hmm. you gave one of the best eulogies I've ever heard.
Thank you.
I re-listened to it earlier this week as I was driving into work, and if somebody would have looked over, and they would have been like, what's wrong with that guy? because I had tears in my eyes. Here's a section of that.
He came out of an era when the game provided not just excitement, but romance. And he remained the perfect embodiment of baseball in the city where baseball matters most. The genuine hero who, as the years and decades passed, and disillusionment came from other directions, never once let us down. And here at home, where it mattered most, we got it. We understood that it's more important to be appreciated than to be glorified, to be respected than to be celebrated, to be understood and loved than to be idolized, and that friendship is more important than fame.
That's Bob Costas eulogizing Stan Musial in 2013. What did it mean to you to give that speech?
It was all the more meaningful because as I looked out over the people in attendance at the church, I saw so many people I knew. So there was a personal connection there. Part of the eulogy, I mentioned Mickey Mantle staying at our home in St. Louis prior to a charity event for the Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital, and Stan and his wife Lil coming over for dinner at my invitation because I wanted Mickey to feel comfortable, have someone he knew. And so I was telling a story about Mickey and Stan. My daughter Taylor went to school with one of Stan's grandchildren, Lindsay, from kindergarten all the way through high school graduation. They were in the same class the whole time. And there was an anecdote about their friendship. It was different than eulogizing Mickey Mantle in Dallas. On both occasions, I tried to speak not just for myself, but for those who had a feeling for Mantle or for Musial. But it was more deeply personal, actually, in St. Louis. I was able to keep my composure, as emotional as it was, in Dallas for the Mantle eulogy. But I kind of got choked up a couple of times with the Musial eulogy, not just because of you're struck by just how deeply decent he was. You know, everyone has different emotional triggers. I get choked up when you hear about something that's decent and kind, more so than I do hearing about something that's sad. That's just me. It's not conscious. It's involuntary. And so I did get choked up a couple of times with the Musial thing.
I've always thought that you've approached your job with a certain amount of journalistic heft that I don't hear in other sports broadcasters.
I
appreciate that as a fan, but also as a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And I especially felt that when you talked about what you thought were the dangers of football.
Yes.
And there are well-documented studies of the effect of concussions mm-hmm. and the effects of it. When you spoke about that, it led to your removal from the broadcast team for the Super Bowl in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
When you had made remarks about the dangers of football, you said, quote, "The reality is that this game destroys people's brains, not everyone's, but a substantial number," end quote. When you made those comments at the time, did you have a sense that it would have the ripple effect that they did?
I knew they weren't happy with me. I knew the NFL wasn't, and some of the people at NBC weren't. I had a great relationship for 40 years with everyone at NBC, and I respected them, and I was grateful to them. But to your point, I did feel that, especially because a lot of my role was as a host, not as a play-by-play guy, and because I'd been in other places like HBO, and I'd even been part of NBC News at times, that I had a different journalistic background or inclination than most sports broadcasters did. Not a criticism of them. There are many who are just splendidly good at what they do, and they're not inclined to do some of the things that I did. My way is not the only way. But to be truthful to myself, I had to acknowledge the elephants in the room. So it wasn't just CTE in football. It was steroids in baseball that were corrupting the record books. It was the IOC's troubling affinity for authoritarian regimes. It was the obvious sham that is the case in too many places in college athletics, where there's almost no relationship, not everywhere, but in many places, between academics and athletics. It's right in front of you. It's the elephant in the room. And I felt like I had to acknowledge some of those things.
And I think a lot of fans appreciate that you did, at the same token, even if some don't. You were part of TBS Sports postseason coverage earlier this fall, and have since announced that you're retiring from baseball baseball play-by-play.
I didn't really announce that. That sounds grand, like, oh, I'd like to call the press in and make a grandiose announcement. But someone at The Athletic, which is now the New York Times sports arm, figured out that because I said something sort of cryptic at the end of the last broadcast, I thanked Ron Darling and mentioned the names of other people I'd worked with through the years. And so this reporter figured out that I might be stepping away from it, and he checked with some people at the MLB Network and TBS, who I had told more than a year ago that this would be my last season. And so when he broke that story, then other outlets picked it up. And the Baseball Network, I very much appreciate this, they immediately started playing retrospectives of games I had called. And they have a series called The Sounds of Baseball, which is an hour-long compilation of calls by various announcers, Vin Scully, Jack Buck, etc. And they had done one on me about a year ago, and they replayed that. So that amplified that I was stepping away from it. So I had
Why is now the right time?
I had to acknowledge it.
Sure, sure. Why now?
Because I felt for the last couple of years that by my own standards, I wasn't quite as good as I used to be. As I said to Tom Verducci, who interviewed me on the Baseball Network a week or so after the story broke, there were games, individual games, or stretches within games, or moments within games, where I was pretty much as good as I've ever been. But I didn't think that I could consistently do it at the level that I'd come to expect from myself. And that is the sole reason. You have a certain lifetime batting average. Some people are content, as long as they can stay in the league, to hit beneath their lifetime batting average. I would have been content if I could hit close to it. But I felt that there was enough of a fall off that I wasn't satisfied with it. I can do everything else, I think, that I ever did just as well. I don't know how much longer I can, but as I sit here at age 72, I can do the essays, the commentaries, the interviews, the specials. I can do all that stuff, and I intend to keep doing all that stuff on a limited basis. I don't want the inventory that I once had. You have to taper off a little bit and give a nod toward Father Time. But play-by-play is a different craft, especially if you try to do it in a certain way. I kind of alluded to this earlier, Alex. If you try to do it in a way that has more texture to it than just ball one, strike two, and there's a ground ball to shortstop. You try to bring all the elements to bear, the anecdotal stuff, the historical stuff, the little asides, maybe a humorous reference. It's a juggling act. And I used to be able to juggle, keep all those balls in the air effectively. And now I just felt like I couldn't do it at a level that I would be 100% content with. So I just felt like it was time to bow out.
You lived in St. Louis for a long time. You came here in 1974, left in 2011 or 12. Even after your career had left St. Louis, you stayed in St. Louis.
And I still feel connected to it. Yeah. I still consider it to be my hometown. I think if I made a list of my closest friends, more than half of them would be St. Louisans. Many of my best personal and professional memories are here. I think I have a great understanding of why St. Louis is such a great baseball city. I just feel a connection that will never go away.
What do you do when you come back?
I visit with friends, and I have family members here as well. If it's during baseball season, even if I wasn't calling a game, I'd go to a couple of Cardinal games, just hang around the press box. And, you know, there's a difference. You have friends. I'm sure you have this too, Alex. You have friends who you go out to dinner with, or you do whatever you do by arrangement. And then you have happy acquaintances who you just see in the natural course of things. You might never say to Joe Blow in the press box, let's go to dinner, or let's grab a burger at O'Connell's or Blueberry Hill, but you're happy to see them. You intersect with them. That's a wider circle than your inner circle of friends. And so I just like to encounter all those people and see their faces again.
You know, I recall Tim McCarver, after he retired from Fox Sports, he would do a Cardinals game every now and then.
Yeah.
Is that, I know you said you're retiring from play-by-play, but is that something that you might like to do?
I don't think so. Sports? I think I've closed that book.
Yeah.
I wish that the Yankee Royal Series had turned out a little better. It wasn't a very exciting series, just as an aside. I was hoping that the Royals would win game four and send it back to Yankee Stadium for a fifth and deciding game, which holds the possibility, at least, of more drama. And Yankee Stadium is a classic setting, but you don't always get what you wish for. But I was certain, absolutely certain, as this season unfolded, that it was time to call it quits.
You did a guest appearance for NBC previewing the Olympics that will be in 2028 in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Anything there?
Yes. Yes. I don't know exactly what shape it will take. I think that we all recognize, I do and the people at NBC do, that after 40 mutually beneficial years, that it ended on a discordant note. And it shouldn't have. I understand why they were uncomfortable with me hosting the Super Bowl, and I didn't really care one way or the other. I had done 6 or 7 Super Bowls. I told them I'd rather interview Roger Goodell for 15 minutes on the Super Bowl than be the host of the Super Bowl. I felt like my best role was kind of as an emeritus person at that point, and a journalist occasionally, or an historian, narrating pieces, rather than being the person who says, "Hey, everybody, it's Super Bowl Sunday." You know, that may have been me at one time. It wasn't me by that time, by 2018. But we got sideways with each other, and there was no, I didn't need a parade, but I just wanted to have some kind of programming that I would host, wouldn't be about me. And then at the end, for 15, 20 seconds, say, "Wow, 40 great years. What a pleasure. What an honor. Thanks to everybody I worked for and with. Thanks to all of you for watching. See you down the road." That's all I wanted, that kind of closure and a grace note, and it never happened. And I think that they now realize, you know, I'm not a bad guy. You know, sometimes you can get sideways with someone, but doesn't mean they're not a good guy. And I don't have any hard feelings toward any of them. And so they reached out and brought us to Paris, which was fun. Got to attend events I didn't have to prepare for and call. Just go to the events as a fan. And then appeared with Mike Tirico on the last night of the Olympics. And with the NBA coming back to NBC a year from now, and with that American Olympics looming in 2028, I think it's actually almost tailor-made for the kind of emeritus role that I'm looking forward to. I'm not going to call the games. I'm not going to be the primary host. But there are little things that I could do that would resonate with the audience, that would remind them of what the NBA on NBC was in the 90s and what the dozen Olympics that I hosted for NBC over a long period of time was like. I think I'm an icing on the cake guy now. I'm not Mike Tirico's the cake. I'm the icing on the cake. Not my best metaphor, but it was all I could muster.
Bob Costas will receive the Musial Awards, Stan Musial Lifetime Achievement Award for Sportsmanship, this Saturday evening at Stiefel Theater. Bob Costas, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Alex, thank you. And may I compliment you on being so well prepared. Sometimes you can just come in and wing it because you got it nailed. But this preparation and the quality of your questions made the conversation better. So I respect and admire that. Thank you.
Yeah, that means a lot. Thank you.
That's sportscaster Bob Costas talking with producer Alex Hoyer. For more on the Musial Awards, including ticket information, visit musialawards.com.
This episode was produced by Alex Hoyer with audio engineering from Maya Norfleet.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.